Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Partee. Ms. Belasis?
May it please the court. The indictment in this case charged with Mr. Partee with distribution of a controlled substance, namely crack. The judge found in a bench trial found him guilty of violating 21 U.S.C. 841A1. At first, the judge's finding of fact and opinion did not specify whether or not the substance, he determined that the substance was crack. Later, he issued a supplemental opinion determining that the government did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the substance was crack. This was an impermissible constructive amendment of the indictment, and it broadened the indictment in violation of the Fifth Amendment. Mr. Partee raised this issue prior to sentencing. In fact, he raised it in a pro se filing on March 30th of 06, and this was just a little over a month after the judge's supplemental opinion. So this issue was preserved.
Why is that preserved? If he is represented by an attorney and the lawyer didn't file that paper.
Well, the lawyer didn't file it, but he himself did.
I know, but you're generally, if you're represented by counsel, you're not permitted to engage in pro se filings.
That's true, but in this case, the judge permitted the filings, and they were made part of the record. In addition, he was having problems with his attorney. He was having disagreements with his attorney, and shortly thereafter, he fired his attorney, or he asked for his attorney to withdraw, and the judge allowed that and appointed other counsel. Now, there, in some cases that discuss forfeiture, there are situations where the court says that this was an open court. The attorney didn't say anything. The defendant didn't say anything either, even though he was standing right there. Well, here the defendant did say something, and he couldn't have done anything more to preserve his rights if he couldn't convince his lawyer to make that objection.
What concerns me about your argument is the fact that this court has held in many instances that allegations of the type of controlled substance in an indictment are really sentencing factors. They're not things that go to the offense itself. And it's my understanding that there was no dispute about whether cocaine had been proven. The whole thing seems to focus on whether it was crack cocaine or some other kind of cocaine. But as long as it was cocaine, he was subject to the statutory maximum that the judge was focusing on.
Well, although that's true, there is a line of cases that says when the indictment is narrowed to something very specific, and that's what the grand jury returns, then you can't make a finding that's outside those parameters. And here, the government narrowed the indictment. I mean, that's why generally the indictments read distribution and possession with intent to distribute, crack and cocaine. You charge in the conjunctive and prove in the disjunctive, and here that wasn't done. It was a very narrow focus of the indictment.
But I guess what we're assuming, or you're assuming, is that this was, in fact, part of the charge, whereas what the government is talking about is whether it's something pertinent only to the sentencing, as long as the jury makes the requisite findings to establish the statutory maximum. And I guess you also need somehow to integrate your idea of constructive amendment with even surplusage in indictments. Sometimes the government throws in facts that just don't need to be there.
Well, that's true, but the cases say that where they limit it and say to wit and specify a certain type of firearm, certain type of offense, a certain type of controlled substance, then they have limited it, the proofs to that indictment. When they just say including, when the indictment says including this substance, then it would be exactly as you've stated, that would be a sentencing issue. But here they didn't say including. It wasn't including crack. It specifically charged him with that substance. It was the indictment stated namely, and Goins, which was an including kind of a charge, stated that to wit means namely, it's specific, exact, and limiting. And that was the situation here. It was that specific.
And I don't have any problem with the idea that the cap on the sentence would have had to follow that sort of thing. And of course, eventually, that's what the district court does when it's taking the evidence that you don't think it should have taken at the sentencing stage. To say that they had to prove in order to get a finding of guilt that it was crack, I think would undermine our decisions in cases like Breaux and Bjorkman.
Well, it all goes back to what the government, it's the government who had control over how the indictment was phrased. And this was how the government chose to present the indictment to the grand jury. And so it does not really reach those other cases like Bjorkman. It has to do with the line of cases that I cited, namely Lichtenham, Willoughby, and Bradley, where the indictment did specify something very specific in the same way, and then the proof was different. And it was held to be reversible per se. I'd like to address the Georgia conviction for a moment. This was a situation where there was a prior that the district court considered to be a controlled substance offense as defined in the guideline 4B1.2B, that's the career offender guideline, and also for purposes of setting the base offense level for the gun guideline 2K2.5 or 2.2.1A, the base offense level.
But you know, your only argument there is that because the Georgia judge decided to give him a 2-year sentence, somehow or another, despite what we can see in his plea colloquy, this wasn't an instance of sale. That I don't see how we can go from the sentence and refute the actual things that this man admitted to before the Georgia judge.
But
he got 2 years for selling a controlled substance, an allegation of sale of cocaine.
Well, the question then is, did he get an illegal sentence, or was he convicted of something
under state law? What difference does it make?
Or was he convicted of a lesser included offense, even though he did actually admit to the distribution?
But there's no evidence in the record of option number two. The only thing in the record is that we have this colloquy, the violation of the Georgia Controlled Substances Act, and what he admits to, which is selling the cocaine. It's more than a 1-year sentence. And so even if the Georgia law was violated, the Georgia judge may have made a mistake, how can we at this juncture say that it doesn't satisfy the federal requirement?
Well, because the charge was ambiguous. It charged possession and it charged distribution. So there's possession, which was one of the charges.
And he admits to the distribution.
Yes, he does.
In open court.
Yes, but a recidivist enhancement depends on what the person stands convicted of, not what he did.
Well, but we've disambiguated it through his admission.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because as a prosecutor, you want a plea to be rock solid, so you'll get the defendant to admit whatever it is that they're willing to admit to, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the plea didn't state that he was pleading guilty to a lesser included offense. Now, we don't have the plea agreement in this case. We have him being charged with violation of the Controlled Substances Act and being found guilty of 2 counts of the Controlled Substances Act. What we have is a plea colloquy where he says what he did, and that does include sale, and then we have a sentence which is for simple possession.
It's more than include sale. I mean, over here on page 45, the state says the evidence would show in this case in the first count an allegation of sale on the 21st of September. Undercover officer and a confidential informant bought $20 worth of cocaine from you. I mean, that's very specific.
Yes, Your Honor, but it does not mean necessarily that he did not plead guilty to the lesser included offense of possession. And it's simply unclear on the record whether that's what he was doing. With respect to relevant conduct, the judge here found him guilty, found Mr. Partee, or found that the prior uncharged conduct of him being found in a residence with 9 firearms counted as relevant conduct. And although the judge did say that there was sufficient here, there was sufficient similarity, regularity, and temporal proximity, the judge did not cite any facts that supported those requirements. And the cases that the judge cited are easily distinguishable regarding these issues. Here, the only thing that's similar is that there is drugs and guns involved. But first of all, there was no showing that that Mr. Partee had constructive possession of these weapons. There's his presence and his knowledge.
Can I ask you? I mean, I think it's you make a strong argument here, but what difference would this make if, in fact, level 34, as the government's supplemental letter suggests, is the correct level for the other charge?
It would make a difference if I win on my first point.
I understand that. But if you didn't, is this sort of get swept into the rest of this?
Well, it would depend on how things go, I guess, on resentencing. But actually, the gun count has the cap of 120 years, so it can't go more than that.
Months?
And, I'm sorry, 120 months.
Yeah, right.
120 months, and it's the drug count that takes it up to 34, unless, of course, you see fit to not count the Georgia conviction as
that would
part
take
of
away
the
career
offender.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palacios. Ms. Fairley.
May it please the Court. The District Court did not amend the indictment by convicting Mr. Partee of the drug charge, despite the fact that the government was unable to prove beyond a reasonable doubt at trial that the substance that Mr. Partee distributed was crack cocaine, as outlined in the indictment. Even though it's alleged in the indictment for the purpose of establishing the statutory maximum, this Court has consistently held the drug type is not an element of the offense and need not be proven at trial beyond a reasonable doubt to sustain a conviction under Title 21 United States Code Section 841A1. In fact, this Court has stated in the past in United States versus Bjorkman, in noting the Supreme Court's affirmance of its opinion in Edward, that the Supreme Court endorsed our conclusion that the judge, rather than the jury, determines the types and quantities of drugs in prosecutions under Section 841. And this holding is incompatible with the characterization that drug type and quantity are elements of the offense.
But I guess what Ms. Bielicis's point is that sometimes indictments are drafted in a way that causes the government to undertake to prove more than maybe it strictly had to prove. And if you drafted such an indictment, maybe you inadvertently imposed upon yourself the burden in this one case to prove that it was crack.
And, Your Honor, our opinion is the way that the indictment was crafted was essentially two parts. The first part is a two-part allegation. The first part is that the defendant distributed a controlled substance, and then the second part of that allegation is that the substance was, in fact, crack cocaine. The fact that the government wasn't able to necessarily prove at trial beyond reasonable doubt the second allegation does not mean that the first allegation falls and that the conviction is therefore invalid. So it is our view that the trial court properly noted that the issue in terms of the determination of whether or not the substance was crack cocaine was properly determined at sentencing under Harris, and it could be determined by the judge based on the preponderance standard.
But you do have to get that statutory maximum set by jury findings. I mean, just a controlled substance could yield a statutory maximum of 5 years if it were marijuana.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
So what? So how do you get to at least the cocaine statutory maximum?
Because the trial court in its findings of fact, well, first of all, the trial court in its findings, in fact, also noted that the parties stipulated that the substance that was distributed was, in fact, cocaine-based. So that has been that was established at trial. And that serves to establish that the statutory maximum applies.
For cocaine.
Okay. For cocaine, yes. Mr. Partee's 1996 Georgia conviction was also properly characterized as a controlled substance offense for the purpose of establishing him as a career offender pursuant to Sentencing Guidelines Section 4B1.1. As noted, the case law in this circuit clearly states that where there is more than one way to violate a statute and where one violation falls within the definition of a recidivism provision and that there are others that do not fall within that definition, the district court is instructed to look at the charging document and the plea colloquy to determine which offense the conviction in the case actually reflects. That's exactly what happened in this case. The trial court looked at the charging document and the plea colloquy, and they both clearly established that the defendant actually sold drugs on two different dates. The indictment states that on two different dates, the defendant did possess and have under his control and sell cocaine. In the plea colloquy, the defendant actually admitted to having sold the cocaine on those two occasions. Now, defendant's argument that the sentence sort of belies that fact and says that there could have been a plea negotiation in which the defendant actually pled to a lesser charge, and that's why the sentence of 2 years was imposed. But clearly, as stated above, this court instructs the trial court to look at the plea colloquy, and there is no ambiguity in those two documents. The sentence may be instructive where there might be ambiguity there, but that's certainly not the case here. And moreover, this court in Sperberg even noted in that case that the defendant only got a slap on the wrist for the offense, but that didn't preclude that offense from being considered appropriately within the definition of that recidivism statute. So,
do we know if there is any way under Georgia law it would ordinarily be possible to tell whether something falls under subpart A of this Georgia statute, the purchase, possess, or have under control, or subpart B of the statute? Because that seems to be what governs whether you can have a minimum of 2 years or a minimum of 5 years.
Other than just outlining the specificity in the charging document, I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how would somebody find out? Because I guess the backup argument that your opponent is suggesting is, in the face of ambiguity, there should be a rule of lenity.
And again, our position is that there really is no ambiguity here. The plea colloquy and the charging document both clearly established that there was a sale and that there is nothing in the evidence, there's no other evidence in the record to suggest that there was some plea discussion or some agreement that the defendant be plead to a lesser charge.
Well, I mean, you say there's no other evidence, but I guess we don't presume that state judges or any other judges willfully give unlawful sentences. And the Georgia law looks fairly clear. It looks like here's where there's a 2-year minimum and here's where there's a 5-year minimum. And so we either have to assume the state judge was asleep at the switch or was just being unlawful or something. What's the theory?
Right. And again, I think it would be inappropriate for me to hypothesize about what the state judge was doing there. All I can say is that there's no indication in the record as to why he gave the 2-year sentence. And yes, it was an unlawful sentence, but there's nothing in the record to indicate why that was done.
Unless there were a plea, you know, unless there had been a plea to a lesser included offense.
That's true, but again, that there was no other indication in the record to suggest that that happened. With regard to the relevant conduct, the district court did not err in finding that the defendant actually possessed those firearms and then also considering that those firearms were relevant conduct for sentencing purposes.
I thought this was a very weak part of the government's argument, this kind of guns and money and drugs going together, and so if you had them at one time, you must have had them at some other time, seems to me so over-inclusive as to be useless.
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that, again, here we're talking about possession of firearms, and the defendant clearly shows a pattern of desiring to possess firearms
illegally.
So it's
a propensity for investment. So if you had firearms, you know, 35 years ago, is that relevant conduct?
Well, I think that that would, in that case, that could conceivably fall outside of the temporal proximity issue.
So why is 6 months or 5.5 months?
Well, again,
they aren't the same guns. They aren't the same place. They aren't the same setting. Nothing is the same except guns, drugs, and money.
Well, I would say that there is similarity in the guns, and that in both situations, defendant actually possessed a MAC-10, which is a particular type of firearm, as well as both situations involved 9mm handguns. So there was some similarity with regard to the type of guns. Yes, in terms of the locality of the possession, that was different. But what's shown here is that the defendant has an interest in possessing guns unlawfully, and the temporal proximity is there in terms of the case cited as Santoro. This court has previously held that a firearm possession within 6 to 9 months is appropriately.
But that's not an ironclad rule. These are circumstantial inquiries, and if you really could show a link, maybe 6 to 9 months isn't so far as to rule it out. But you need a little bit more than just say, 6 months it's in, 9 months it's out, or 2 years it's out. I don't see anything other than the fact that there are guns and drugs and money that links these.
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, if you look at it from the perspective of defendant had a stash of guns in January of 2003, mm-hmm. and those were taken away from him, he's not going to go out and possess guns again right away because he's being scrutinized. But 6 months later, then he goes out and possesses guns again. I think that is indicative of a pattern. And of a pattern of conduct and should be considered relevant conduct in the case. Again, there is also the similarity of the guns that were involved in the two possessions.
Would you agree that this doesn't make any difference if, in fact, the government prevails on the indictment and state conviction points?
So unless there are any other questions, I would just conclude and ask that this court affirm defendant's conviction and remand again for the limited purpose of resentencing defendant based on the corrected guideline calculations that were outlined in the government's letter that was submitted recently. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fairley. Ms. Palacios.
Regarding the relevant conduct, Ms. Fairley just mentioned that the similarity was that there were two MAC-10s involved, one in the first one, one in the second one. Well, there was a MAC-10 in the house in the first instance, but in the charged conduct, it's the government that supplied the MAC-10. There is no indication that there was any specific request for that, and so that cannot be considered as a similarity that would cause this to be relevant conduct, or the government would be creating relevant conduct.
Except the transaction here was drugs being traded for guns and money, right? No?
That's correct.
So that's not the typical money for crack or money for drugs deal.
Well, I'm not sure what would be the typical one. This was a trade of 9mm guns, which is a fairly common type of pistol, mm-hmm. and a MAC-10 that the government supplied.
I'm saying that I think you'd have a much better argument on the remoteness of the guns that were in his possession 6 months before if this was a straight drugs for money deal.
Well, that's true. And the other one, there was one handgun that was close to him. The other guns were simply in the same house where he was, in the basement. He was nowhere close to them. He knew about them, but there was no indication that he actually possessed a stash of guns. There was no evidence of that. There was no evidence that he had any kind of dominion or control, that it was his house, that he lived there, none of those facts. And as far as the Georgia conviction, counsel stated that if the charging document is unclear, you look to the plea colloquy. It's not just the plea colloquy. You look to all official documents is what the cases say. And so the sentencing and what the law says that sentence means would be considered an official document and would be something that would be appropriate for this court to take a look at to determine whether that in fact qualifies for career offender status. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Melissa. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.